Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. Glad you could listen. During this hour of the show, women's health is a topic, something we do periodically on the show with Suzanne Troopin. She's a physician, also a professor of obstetrics and gynecology here at the University of Illinois, also a practicing physician and director of research projects on a variety of health matters pertaining to women. Also, she's now engaged in cosmetic medicine. She needs a clone or two, as do we all, but especially Suzanne. But anyway, she's here during this next hour to take your questions on women's health issues. We'll talk about a few things that might be topical. But if you have questions, that's the point of this show, is to help you out if we can. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, so if you're outside of Champaign-Urbana, if you're listening online, for example, you can use our toll-free line, 800-222-9455, and your questions are welcome. And Suzanne Troopin, good morning.
Good morning.
Always glad to see you here.
Thanks. Good to see you.
Yeah. So what's new?
Well, there's quite a bit that's new, of course, in my field, and I think we already talked about this on my last show, that HPV vaccine being new is very exciting news. And for many of us that are actually in the healthcare field, trying to figure out who, what, and when, particularly who's going to pay for the vaccine, it's a fairly expensive series, is an important issue. And I'd be happy to answer questions on that. You and I were briefly talking about the fact that Plan B, an emergency contraceptive pill, is going to be available over the counter. And that's very exciting. We have a couple of new birth control pills that are coming out. We have a new birth control implant that's out. The CDC is trying to get us to do more HIV testing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff out there that we can discuss.
Well, let's talk about the new birth control implant, different drugs. What is new about this stuff?
Well, one of the problems that we have in the United States is that we still have the highest unplanned pregnancy rate in the developed world. And the question is why. So basically, one in four pregnancies does end in elective discontinuation, which is very controversial in our country. Mm-hmm. But what's more important is approximately half of all pregnancies are quote unquote unplanned. And that is just not the healthiest way to embark upon a pregnancy. We want to make sure people are on vitamins. We want to make sure people are vaccinated and current on those, that people don't have nutritional deficiencies or other medical issues that need to be addressed, like blood pressure problems or blood sugar problems. And going into a pregnancy in a planned way is best, so that contracepting effectively until you decide to become pregnant is what is best. And birth control pills, when used in research studies, are essentially 99%+ effective. Mm-hmm. So what's the problem? We have effective medicine for this. Well, the problem is not everybody can take them safely. The problem is dosing and side effects, irregular bleeding. The problem is inconvenience, so that if you are a woman taking birth control pills over every single day over 5 years, you're going to swallow more than 1,800 pills if you do the math. And that's very difficult to be consistent. So anything that we do to make it easier and still make it work are big improvements in the area of contraception. So, for instance, the patch, where you only change your patch three times a month, is much more likely for patients to actually use it and be successful in using it. And they've shown that it is associated not only with better health, but less expense, because the planning aspect. And with the vaginal ring, where you put a ring in and leave it there for 3 weeks and then take it out, again, one health behavior instead of 28 in a month is much easier for people. And we had the Norplant 5-rod implants. Well, the trouble is it's a tough commitment to do that for 5 years. Their insertion was very easy, but removal really, if you were a surgeon, removal was nothing. But if you weren't a surgeon, if you were a nurse who primarily did not do surgery, removal, depending on the insertion, was a little bit more difficult. So there's a one rod system. It's easier to insert, easier to remove, and has been approved for a little while, hasn't quite made it to the shelves. You know, that takes a little bit. And then finally, we realized there are still many instances where, for whatever reason, people have had unprotected intercourse. And sometimes it may be something as simple as a condom breaking. And if you have unprotected intercourse in the middle of your cycle, about 8% of people conceive. And if you take this emergency contraceptive protection, the common nickname is morning after pill, under 1% of women will conceive. So it is excellent medicine and can dramatically reduce the unplanned pregnancy rate. The problem has been access, access, access. So many people who want emergency contraceptive protection just were not getting it. Mm-hmm. And by going over the counter, we hope to eliminate that problem.
We have a call to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. I'll mention the phone numbers again if you would like to. Any questions about women's health issues? Dr. Suzanne Troopen is with us during this hour. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Take your pick. We'll go next to Champagne Listener, line number one. Good morning.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Okay, so a few girlfriends and I, all in our 40s, we're talking, and we figure, okay, menopause will start soon, and so that means fewer eggs, right? So fewer chances of getting pregnant. So we're talking about contraception and what kinds. And so when you're getting to the point where, you know, your chances are lower anyway, what are some of the best methods to use that aren't so either invasive or as, you know, having to take the pill every single day when the chances are lower anyway? And could you talk a little bit about how that, you know, it'd be great if I could see a chart somewhere, and maybe you can give a website where it shows as you, you know, as you age, what's the average risk, I guess, the, you know, the
your fecundity. We call it fecundity. What is your likelihood of getting pregnant? And when we do pregnancy contraception research, and when I talk to patients, we talk about effectiveness from the standpoint of what's called the Pearl Index. And the Pearl Index is really easy to understand. You get 100 women using the method for 1 year. At the end of that 1 year, how many are pregnant?
Okay.
So that the Pearl Index for birth control pills and studies is one woman is pregnant. For women out there in the real world, four, five, or six are pregnant at the end of the year because they don't necessarily stay on them or use them consistently. And for barrier methods, new start barrier method patients, the somewhere 15 to 20 of them may be pregnant at the end of the at the end of the 1 year. But if you as a couple have been using a barrier method for more than 2 years, you jump into a successful user category and failure rates go dramatically down up into almost getting close to what the new pill users are doing. So there's a number of factors. In the United States, about one third of couples over the age of 35 are sterilized. And you know, that means a vasectomy or a tubal. And now we have this Esure contraceptive methods, these little coils, and you can go in your doctor's office and you can look in through your cervix after we maybe give you a little bit of medicine for cramping, possibly a little sedative, depends on your comfort area. I do some of them under general anesthesia, but most people will not need that. In 10 minutes, we can insert those coils, boom, right up into where the fallopian tubes and the uterine lining.
So is that like an IUD kind of thing?
Kind of it is. It's called Esure, and they have a great website with cute little pictures and how to do it. They're little coils, very little. Like if you've ever, you know, had a pen explode open, that coil, that, you know, that little spring,
yeah, right.
It's actually a lot smaller and thinner than that. Okay. And it does not go off when you go through the, if my patient who asked me this question last week, but it doesn't go off when you go through, you know, monitors or whatever, even though it is metal. And it scars into place. And the disadvantage of this one is that you need to come back in 3 months and we need to do an x-ray to make sure that the little coil scarred into place correctly. But once they've scarred into place correctly, there is no such thing as failure. It's a great method. Now, also the Mirena IUD, it has a little bit of progesterone. So the amount of systemic hormone you get is almost zip. There's some theory that that local progesterone might even treat early endometriosis. Haven't really studied that very much. It's approved for 5 years of use in the United States, but in places in Europe, it's approved for 7 years. So it's a good long-term method. And the great news about Mirena is that women have fewer periods. Lighter periods. Mm. Unlike the Paragard, approved for 10 years, great IUD. But it also can slightly, because of the copper in the Paragard IUD, it can slightly increase your periods. But Mirena IUDs are great. So sterilizations, IUDs are great for people in their 40s.
Okay.
The problem with the perimenopausal aspect is you can't beat the pill for increasing regularity of your cycles and treating those early premenopausal symptoms like hot flashes. And so we're looking at new and better ways of doing the pill. So Librel is about to come on the market. I participated in this study, and it's an entire 1 year where you take a pill every day. Yeah, more pills rather than less.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, the same thing every day. You don't have to remember on 21, off 7.
Okay.
And about half of all women will stop having periods when they do that. And that's very convenient for many people as well. There also is that seasonal pill that is formulated, 84 active pills, 7 off, so 4 periods a year.
So how do these things affect the onset of menopause, or do they?
They don't.
Oh.
We have 4 million eggs when we're, as soon as we get an ovary in fetal life, we have about 4 million eggs. By the time we're born, we lose 3 million of them somehow. They start dying off as soon as we get them.
Wow.
And actually, we're born with 1 million eggs, and we ovulate about 400. And yes, if you run out of eggs in your 20s, boom, you're in menopause.
Okay.
If you run out of eggs in your 30s, boom, you're in menopause.
Okay, so that's really.
But for most of us, we run out of eggs around the same time, and pretty much all of us have menopause at 51.4 years.
Okay, so it's like around 50. So if we're in our 40s, we're still pretty fertile, right?
We're pretty fertile. For people still having their periods up until their early to mid-50s, about 55% will have escape ovulations.
Okay. Okay,
so that many of my patients that do go on the birth control pill in their 40s actually won't stop their pill until their early to mid-50s.
Okay, but they still go through menopause anyway.
Through menopause. They just don't know it.
Okay.
Because the pill is controlling both their hormones and their ovulation.
So there's
no signal.
So come the age of 55 then, do you just get off and
pretty much
okay, and
pretty
then
much.
And then the all those things that you got through, all those symptoms you got through without any problems, do they come back or they're gone too?
That's the problem. It's once you get off your birth control pills, then your natural menopause kicks in. And 3% of all women in the United States won't have a single symptom. But the 97% of the rest of us will have some sort of symptoms. For some, women, it's mild. For some women, it's more severe. And then you deal with the menopausal aspect and then you have to take 3 steps back with your clinician, your gynecologist, your primary health guider, and say, you know, what else is going on here?
Okay.
Are you overweight? Are you at risk for cardiovascular disease? Does your mom have osteoporosis? How is your sex drive? And about 40% of women at that age have sex drive issues. So exactly what kinds of health issues are important to you will then drive the next step.
I see. Okay. So you can postpone most of the symptoms, but not forever.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay, well, good. Okay, thanks for that information.
Thanks for the call. We have another call waiting, and let me mention the phone numbers again. We're talking with Dr. Suzanne Trubin about women's health issues. If you want to join us, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. An Urbana listener next, line number 2. Good morning.
Hello, Dr. Trubin. I'm interested in discussing the problem of the dropped uterus. I'm in my 60s, and my physician mentioned that I had a dropped uterus on my annual exam. I do have some of that incontinence. I forget the first name of it. But I was wondering what is the current belief about having any kind of repair for this condition, and will it really help in the incontinence situation?
Okay, excellent questions. Difficult topic. In the times, I wish I was on television with my little blackboard. But basically, our pelvic floor is a giant sling. And it's it has many layers. It's perforated by the urethra, the vagina, and the rectum. So as we get older, the reason that we're continent when we're younger is that sling, when we cough, contracts around the skinny little urethra and blocks off any urine from the bladder to getting out. As that sling breaks down, the bladder neck, where the urethra and the bladder join, moves down, and it's so the coughing, number one, the muscles aren't so good, the nerves, number two, the nerves aren't so good, and we lose that angle, and so the squeezing sometimes is around like the base of the bladder, and instead of where the urine comes out, and so it pushes out the little bit of urine that is collecting in our bladder since the last time we went to the bathroom. And that's a condition called stress incontinence. And that condition probably is not intrinsically in any way, shape, or form tied to whether or not your uterus is dropping, although many women have both conditions, like you're mentioning. So that fixing that is often done in an anatomical way. So there's not really very good medicine to fix it. Oddly, the new antidepressant drug by Eli Lilly, Cymbalta, was found in clinical trials to help some incontinence. And we participated actually in that study as well, where we were testing Cymbalta, an antidepressant, for incontinence. And now it's actually approved as an incontinence drug in Europe. They have not done the approval process for it. But it is, if you want to try a drug, it's one of the few you can actually try. Pessary use. These are rubber devices. They come as rings or donuts or cubes. They come in all kinds of different configurations. And essentially, it's usually a latex rubber device. Can't use if you're latex allergic. You place it into the vagina. Actually, I should take that back because I think they do have some polyurethane ones. But anyway, you place it into the vagina and it stays. Take it out. Wash it, put it on a shelf, let it dry, put it in the next day, and it works quite well, but it's fussy. You have to deal with it every day, and there are some that are specifically designed to correct incontinence. There are some that are specifically designed to push that prolapsed uterus back up, and there are some that are designed for rectal incontinence as well, but they don't work as well. Now, the uterus has two main supporting structures, and as they are actually part of this giant pelvic sling, as they get stretched out and as we have kids, that uterus can move down, and if it's mild amount of prolapse, then the uterus moves down a little bit. If it's moderate, actually the cervix is sitting almost at the opening of the vagina. You can wash your hands and figure out where your cervix is. Your cheeks are muscle and your nose is made of cartilage. The cervix is a combination of muscle and cartilage. So what you're looking for is something that feels a little harder than your cheek and a little softer than your nose. And when women have complete prolapse, they get to a condition where the vagina is almost physically turned inside out like a sock, and the uterus is actually sitting physically outside the body. That has to be fixed. That's not a good condition because it's uncomfortable. That tissue wasn't meant to live outside our body. It's like when we hang our tongue out of our, when we get a cold and, you know, our mouth is open, we're not designed to be that way. So that tissue does not hold up well when it's in that condition. It's not so common anymore because people don't have as many kids. And back in the day when lots of women had 8, 10, 15 kids, we saw it all the time. When you have only one or two kids and you have a C-section on top of that, well, you're not as likely to get it. Not that it's impossible, because there is some force on the pelvic floor just from carrying a baby as well as birthing that baby. And that's what usually is the condition of prolapse. So bottom line, most of these conditions are correctable surgically. And when to have that is really a decision between you and your healthcare provider, seeing what the progression is, what your actual symptoms are, whether you're a candidate for a pessary, that sort of thing. The bladder repairs, we have radically reformed how we do those, and we use these little mesh weaves that are just laid at the angle, and they're designed to have our own tissue regrow and reform the anatomical sling. And the complication rate of those surgeries is just nothing. The recovery time, I mean, not nothing, but so low compared to the older operations. Recovery time is just radically faster than the old operations. People go home. They don't necessarily, on the day of surgery, they don't necessarily have catheters in. And the overcorrection rate, meaning that it's too hard to start to pee, is very low. And these operations are very good, and they're done mostly by gynecologists or urologists. And so a primary health care provider would probably have to refer you to someone to do a consultation to see if you were right for that kind of surgery. And they're covered by insurance and Medicare and public aid plans, all of it.
Well, I really
those operations are covered.
That's a very comprehensive overview, and I really appreciate knowing that. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks so much for the call. We have another caller waiting on line number one in Charleston. Good morning.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
For the previous conversation that was dealt with contraceptives, and I was curious if there was ever any thought or studies done on
men. And there is, and I do read it sort of out of the corner of my eye. The problem is your physiology is a lot different than ours. And we can suppress ovulation fairly effectively with women without so dramatically altering our hormone levels. But the best way to suppress your sperm count is also to dramatically suppress testosterone. And that combination right there is just not a good one for male sexuality. So that has been one of the big holdups. Back when I was a resident many, many moons ago, the Chinese were studying something called Gossypol, which was a cottonseed oil extract. And it was great at causing sperm to you looked at them under the microscope and they just weren't healthy. They just look exploded sort of under the microscope. And it was very effective. And they actually tested it in many, many people. But it was just way too toxic to consider as a realistic male contraception. So they've been working on, I think, vaccines against sperm production. They've worked on various things that would maybe suppress testosterone a little bit, not a lot, so that it would suppress production. And of course, vasectomies and the, you know, better ways of doing vasectomies, but that's permanent and not obviously something good. Better spermicides for use as a couple, better comfort in condoms, and we definitely have better condoms and lots more condom choices than we ever had before. And I know that there's other research going on as well. I just haven't really read up on much of it. The American Social Health website is a great one. I think for the other caller too, I didn't give out any websites. The Population Council has a lot of good health information. They have a good website as well. The Association of Reproductive Health Professionals, and I think it probably is ARHP.org, is a good website as well. There's tons of information out there, but nothing that's nearing clinical rollout. And I've never actually participated in any of the male contraceptive studies, so I'm not as up on those. But thanks for calling.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. We're just past our midpoint here with Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She's a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine, also a practicing physician. And we're talking about women's health issues. If you have questions, that's what the show is all about. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. If you're outside the 217 area code, you can use that, and we'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455. Well, lacking callers, anything else
you want to talk about? We were talking about contraception and hormone levels, and it definitely brings up the subject of sexual drive for women. Mm-hmm. We know that, I think I already said this, that about 40% of women that go into their menopause have decreased sexual drive. Probably somewhere between 10 and 20% of younger women, and, you know, increasingly more common as they get older, have decreased sexual function as well. For many people, it's decreased desire. For other people, it's decreased arousal. And there are no approved treatments for this in the United States. And this is where much of our research focus is going. There are a couple of new creams that you can buy that have botanical extracts, and they have a tiny bit of science behind them, not a lot, nothing published in the actual medical journals that we all as physicians read. So we haven't really been privy to the science behind it, in part because they don't need to publish that. They can keep it as proprietary information to bring the product to the market. And I have not seen any patients with undue side effects. Everybody can be allergic, you know, to something, so you have to be careful about that, but probably worth trying.
Well, we have several callers suddenly. Let's go ahead and talk with them. Next up, someone on a cell phone, line number 4. Good morning. Hello. Yes.
Yes, thank you. I have an observation. I'm wondering if you think there's any validity to it. At one point, I was really watching my carbs, still trying to be healthy with it, but watching them, and I didn't know it was going to be an effect. Not only did I feel great, but my period had no cramps, no bloating, no crabbiness, no side effects whatsoever. And I was wondering if you think there was any validity to that, and if you think knocking off the bad carbohydrates such as white sugars and stuff might also reduce your menopausal symptoms, which I'm not in yet, but I'm wondering.
Well, definitely our sugar levels can affect our insulin, which can affect hormones. And without knowing more about your individual case, it'd be a little tough to say for sure. There have been lots of studies showing that exercise can regulate menses and decrease cramps, but not so much in terms of specific diets. Now, in the United States, when we have very, very high protein diets, the Atkins / South Beach / we just all eat too much steak type of diets, we worry that some of the hormones fed to our cows in the beef industry can adversely affect periods. And there's a little bit of science behind that, but not so much tied to exactly the carbohydrates. And when I talk to my patients who are eating better, they're usually exercising better too. And so sometimes it's hard to know which thing was the cause of that, but it's really good for you anyway. So even if we can't figure out the science quite yet, I would definitely recommend watching the Simple Sugars.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call. A couple of the calls waiting. We'll go next to a listener in Paris, line number 1. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Troopin?
Yes.
I have a question regarding osteopenia. I was on hormone replacement therapy after menopause. I'm in my late 60s now. My bone scans were very good until I went off slowly hormone replacement therapy with Premarin. I'm looking at what do you think about natural hormones as being possibly more safe, especially as far as potential effect on breast cancer and, more importantly, stroke?
Okay. Well, there's lots of different questions here. Definitely the estrogen you were on before was helping your bone.
Right.
Once you've been off estrogen for more than a year, whatever effects that estrogen was having on your bone have now worn away, and what your bone testing is now reflecting is more what your normal state should be. For women who have low bone mass, or you're using the term osteopenia, which those of us that have been certified in densitometry, we're actually trying to get rid of that term, but most doctors use it anyway. You're not at great risk yet for bone fractures, but you are at risk for osteoporosis in the future. So doing something for bone health is important. Got to exercise, got to get a reasonable amount of calcium. Have to get a good level of vitamin D. And then the question is when you are going to use some kind of medication. Mm-hmm. Estrogen's in the mix of the discussion. But the question is when you're going to use some sort of treatment for your bones. And for bones, we usually look at your age at the things like the bisphosphonates or the CIRMs. The only CIRM in the United States that's on the market so far is Avista, and we're hoping that the FDA will approve it soon as a breast cancer prevention treatment as well as for bone health. Those are the two categories. The current recommendation is, in a very simplistic way, without knowing your individual case and so forth, is that if you don't have another reason to be on estrogen and you haven't failed management with these other things or don't have contraindication to these other things, we don't primarily use estrogen to treat low bone mass if we can use something else. So yes, it's approved for prevention of osteoporosis. Yes, it works. But because of the potential side effects of estrogen and the diminishing returns as we get older from estrogen, we look at other things as bone treatment rather than estrogen. Now, in terms of the breast cancer specifically issue with natural estrogen versus estrogen, first of all, there is so much confusion as to what you mean by natural. And so first we have to come up and agree together what that definition is. But for many people, it means trying to use compounds that are made by the female human body, as opposed to some compound that's made by something else. But most of the quote-unquote natural formulations that haven't shown a lot of breast cancer risk, unfortunately, weren't really tested for as long. Many times those studies were 3-month studies, 6-month studies. Very few of the bioidentical studies were done for even as much as 1 year. And you're just not going to see an accurate picture of breast cancer risk from a short study. Basically, the FDA tells us that if it is an estrogen, whether it's a cream or a patch or a pill or a quote-unquote natural pill, basically, if it's an estrogen and you're taking it in a similar dose, all of those formulations will have approximately the same breast cancer risk. And progesterone in conjunction for women who do have a uterus may change that risk, but all estrogens have some risk. And we don't know what that risk is exactly, but probably at least one extra breast cancer per 1,000 women per year, something like that.
What about stroke?
In terms of strokes, individuals on hormone replacement therapy have an increased risk of clotting type strokes, not necessarily the hemorrhagic kinds of strokes, the bleeding kinds of strokes, but slightly increased risk. And the magnitude of that risk, again, probably very similar for most of the estrogens, although probably taking your estrogen transdermal, like in a cream or a gel or a patch rather than in a pill, probably would alter the clotting factors of your liver a little bit less and have a little bit lower rate, but not enough where the FDA has come out and said you use one versus the other to prevent stroke. So your rates of stroke are going to creep up over your natural rate, which is increasing as we age. And also stroke risk is very tied in to other cardiovascular risks. What's your blood pressure? Are you taking aspirin? You know, how clogged are your arteries? What's your cholesterol? Is your good cholesterol good? Is your bad cholesterol low? And so those factors so impact stroke that the whole estrogen question almost pales when compared to your overall cardiovascular health.
Okay, thank you very much. I was concerned about Actonel and Fosamax because of some of the bad press that they're getting with all of the lawsuits on Fosse jaw and
the osteonecrosis of the jaw. Yep. And I prescribe multiple doses of both those medicines every day, never seen a case. Now, doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. That's definitely an issue, and it's important that we know about it, and it's important that we have good gum health before we start those medications.
Hope that gives the callers questions. We have another caller waiting and probably time for others. We're talking with Dr. Suzanne Troopin, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois College of Medicine, also a practicing physician, joins us every once in a while to take your questions on women's health issues. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. And Urbana listener next, line number two. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Dr. Troopin. I have a question that's pretty involved, but I'll just basically I'm looking for some guidelines on this. I've been in a stable relationship for a long time, and I have not been interested in having sex with my partner for about 8 years. And I am in my late 50s. And obviously I've gone postmenopausal and all that. I'm in therapy about it. I'm just not interested. And I'm wondering if there is some sort of testing that can be done of my system to alert me maybe and others that are working with me in terms of maybe there's something off in my hormonal system that I'm not aware of.
Well, definitely your primary health care provider or gynecologist that works in this area can give you a consultation and figure out what contributing factors there are. Medications can cause this. Menopause can cause this. Low estrogen can cause this. Low testosterone can. And there's probably other factors as well. We don't have too many good treatments. Actually, in menopausal patients, the use of testosterone has been very successful. And we don't currently have any trials enrolling. I participated in the, I think they're going to call it Intrinsa, the testosterone patch studies, and we'll probably be enrolling more of those studies in the near future, specifically looking at menopausal women. We're doing two different studies of decreased sexual function in lower women, one group for decreased sex drive, one group for decreased arousal, and we may be we're looking at starting into these other branches. It's, you know, they when they do these trials, and I've talked about this a lot before, they round up investigators across the nation, and they pick different people for different branches of the study, and that's how they get done. So hopefully there will be more out there, but definitely looking at your estrogen and testosterone levels and whether or not you'd be a candidate for shorter or longer term therapy is something that you can look at.
Okay, will do. Thanks a lot.
All right, thanks for the call. We have another listener waiting on line number four, Hammond, Indiana, next. Good morning. Is there a caller there?
Hello?
Hello.
Yes, I have a question. What do you do for someone that's had a hysterectomy, a complete hysterectomy, and has hot flashes? Has my sister has breast cancer. My father and brother died of hemorrhagic strokes. My mother had cancer. What do I do to enjoy life?
Well, definitely hot flashes can make us miserable. In the medical world, we call these vasomotor symptoms. Some people flash. Some people get colds. Chills, some people get profuse sweating, some people wake up at night, and it's all pretty much due to the same brain physiology. It's extremely well treated by estrogen. And there are some groups of people that are probably so at risk they should try to avoid estrogen, but ultimately probably estrogen is, I will talk about what alternatives are, but for many people out there, estrogen probably is going to be the only way. And what can work is to start on very low doses and get to the lowest dose that's effective, then be treated and stable for a while and then work closely with your doc to get off and get on to something else. And that seems to be successful for many high-risk individuals. Also, if you do have a strong family history of breast cancer, talk to your physician about getting tested for the BRCA1 and 2 genes and see if you're actually a gene carrier, or if you don't have that gene in your family, you may not be as high at risk as you think. Problem with that test? Over $3,000. So you want good insurance before you get that test. Don't just get out there and give them your blood. Discuss it first. In terms of alternatives, boy, there really aren't good ones. We have studied some of the antidepressants. Prozac, Zoloft, a few others have worked, Paxil, and reasonable, again, for many people to try those. We have also studied some of the antihypertensive medicines. Again, works for some people. The current favorite alternative is to use one of the anti-seizure medicines. So this gabapentin is used by some doctors, but when you read the side effects and what it's for, some of my patients haven't been so interested. There is Belergals. It's a distant cousin of LSD. It is a belladonna alkaloid, but nobody gets hallucinations on it. But it is a fairly good treatment as well. I've used it in many patients with active breast cancer, and it can be safely, but you'd have to, you know, look at the, if you're on other medicines, the contraindication, drug interactions are a problem with Belergals and prevent a lot of people from using it. And actually, we're going to be, that's an area of menopausal treatments without using estrogen is one of my main areas of research interest. So we have a couple of research studies going on treating vaginal dryness with these newer compounds to try to look at estrogen alternatives. And we're going to be starting a symptom study with a SNRI. And it is in the antidepressant category. It's a new medicine, and we're going to be studying its effectiveness for menopausal symptom relief, because most patients who come to me for consultations who've tried some of those antidepressants haven't yet been successfully treated. For women who can take hormone therapy but still aren't successfully treated, one of the things we're looking at is whether pure testosterone versus pure estrogen versus a combination is a good thing. And so we have one trial of that enrolling as well. So it is a hot area of research. And hopefully, even for those who can't or won't or too far to participate in research studies, hopefully the science will have something for you in a few years.
Okay.
Get your questions?
I hope there's something.
Yes, it can make people very miserable.
Okay, well, thanks for the call. We have just about maybe 6 minutes left with Dr. Suzanne Troopin. Our lines are open. If you want to get in real quick, we'll try to get to your question in the time remaining. 333-9455. That's around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Do you want to talk about skin medicine, cosmetic medicine,
well,
at all?
Yes. I mean, one of the important things is our whole issue of sun damage and where this takes us relative to skin cancer risks. And any of us who work in the area of primary care are constantly sampling things that are cancerous in spite of treatment of the precancerous lesions that we get from sun. So sometimes you might look in the mirror and think you just have a little bit of, oh, age spots, and yet those sometimes can be actual actinic keratosis that are precancerous. Mm-hmm. So some of what we do for cosmetics is not only for looking good and preventing wrinkles. Some of it is, in fact, somewhat health beneficial as well. And some of the health benefits are more just looking better and feeling better.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, like other areas of the feel better aspects of our life, isn't always covered by insurance. But still, it's a good bridge between the science and the cosmetic aspects of taking care of your skin.
Well, maybe we'll follow up on that. We have another call to include.
Okay.
Let's do that. Someone in Central Illinois, line number 4. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I have a question. Perhaps it's already been answered, but I just tuned in a while ago. Regarding the over-the-counter estrogen, you know, natural soybean-based estrogen blends, sometimes they also have black cohosh and
other. Good point, and I didn't really mention them. But go ahead. Yeah.
Are they also, how effective are they? And all, and do they also pose a hazard with regards to strokes? And should everybody be taking, something like if I'm 56, going to be 57, should I take an aspirin every day, or how about flaxseed oil or fish oil also?
Okay. Probably too many questions for me to get answered, but let me try. So definitely black cohosh has been studied for treatment of menopausal symptoms, and it works better than placebo, but nowhere near as effectively as other medications. So it, for most people, it is harmless and can be tried. And if it's effective, great. In places like Germany that has this commissionee, where all their they regulate their botanicals very closely, they don't really recommend it for more than 6 months of use. But I do have many patients that have used it for more than 6 months and safely. And we usually just get yearly blood work and just basic checkups, and
what's
that's really all we do.
Being with black cohosh with the blood work?
It just hasn't been studied long term. So what the exact long term effects? They don't really know. Could be a variety of side effects. The other problem with herbal medications that you do have to read the labels, because certain combinations are somewhat potentially hazardous. So a lot of plants have coumadin-like substances, which could increase bleeding. And even the omega-3 fatty acid supplementations that you can find in fish oil has now been reported to increase bleeding. And so you have to be very careful. So that brings me to the aspirin question. And it depends on who you are and what you are. If you've had a heart attack, yes. If you have high cardiovascular risk, yes. And yet if you, and I, you know, for your age group, it may be a little bit different. But in younger age groups, there was one study of aspirin supplementation in women. And I think they said that probably out of every 5 people, 2 were protected against blood clots in their brain. One or two probably didn't make a difference one way or the other based on what their risk was at the time they were taking it. And 1 or 2, so I know I'm not quite adding up to 5, but the stats were a little different in a couple of different studies, actually had GI bleeds or were more at risk for hemorrhagic bleeds in their head. So there are some people that shouldn't be taking aspirin, and you have to work with your primary health care provider and find out. I always, if I could, I would like with my patients to be able to do a test and then say, based on these tests, this is what you as an individual need. Now, we don't always have the right test to answer every question. But at least for aspirin, if your C-reactive protein is up, your cardio C-reactive protein's up, and things like homocysteine are up, and you have lipid problems, and possibly there are about 6% of us that have Leiden factor 5, that's a clotting, predisposes us to clots. And these people may really benefit by aspirin use. So you might want to also talk to your primary care provider about whether or not you need tests or whether or not you need aspirin.
Okay. And with just taking the over-the-counter soy-based estrogen.
The problem is that
is that effective with, I have hot flashes still. It seems to...
soy foods are great food. They do a lot for us nutritionally. And I think it's important for us to add some soy. But plant estrogens are weak, and we can't usually accomplish the bone health or the hot flash success that we can with other hormones.
Okay, well, I hope that gets the caller's question. I guess we're here at the end of our time, and we've run out of callers, and I will just mention again our guest, Dr. Suzanne Troopen, joins us to take your questions on a regular basis on women's health issues, and you also have a new cosmetic medicine practice that...
Yes, it's going to be called Hada Cosmetic Medicine, and I'm partnering with a couple other doctors and estheticians, and it's going to be an area of excitement.
So you're finally going to be busy.
Exactly. Keeps us young, doesn't it?
Right, exactly. Dr. Suzanne Troopen, professor of obstetrics and gynecology, University of Illinois College of Medicine, also women's health practice here in Champaign. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks.